Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times. Today we are speaking with Rida Fakhri, an international broadcast journalist with over 20 years of experience as a reporter, news anchor, opinion writer, and moderator based in Washington, D.C. We discussed Rida's career as a journalist and a woman in the field, how she prepares for interviews and moderates panels in global forums, the state of the U.S. democracy, and advice for students who want to pursue a similar career.
It's 5:05, so I think we can get started. And if other people join, that's great. Okay, so just something before. Please turn on your cameras if you have the opportunity to do so. I understand that some of you are in uni, so you can't turn on your cameras, but if you can, please do so that we can like have a as close to in-person event as possible. Otherwise, very, very happy to see you today. And it's very lovely to see some familiar names. I do hope that anyone who is new at LSE and new at the Grimshaw Club, you're very, very welcome as well. It's lovely to have you. Before I introduce Rida and we can get started, just a few technicalities on Zoom. As you can see, you're all muted right now. It won't be that way the whole time. There will be time for questions and I want you to be able to ask the questions yourselves. So when Q&A time comes, definitely turn on your mic and ask your question. However, I would really appreciate if you would write your questions in the chat before we move on so that I can see them and then I will let you ask the question yourself. But I would really appreciate if you could write it first in the chat now or throughout the conversation or when it's time for questions. Does anyone have a particular concern about that? If not, brilliant, and I'll get started. Also, I do hope my internet connection is good. If you stop seeing me, but you can still hear me, that's great. If you stop hearing me, text in the chat. Thank you. Okay, brilliant. So I'll start by introducing Rida. Thank you so much for joining us today. It is a huge, huge honor to have you with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm very, very happy. So Rida is an international broadcast journalist with over 20 years of experience as a reporter, news anchor, opinion writer, and moderator. She's currently based in Washington, D.C. and presents a current affairs program for the international broadcaster TRT World. She's also a contributor to the Huffington Post and a regular moderator at UN conferences and other global forums. Rida started her career as a political correspondent for a leading UK-based Middle East newspaper before moving into television news. As a New York bureau chief for Al Jazeera, she covered the 9/11 attacks on World Trade Center and its aftermath. She reported on location from Iraq and Afghanistan following the US-led invasion in 2003. She has also reported extensively from the United Nations in New York. She traveled with Secretary General Kofi Annan throughout the Middle East and Africa, and she has also conducted in-depth interviews with several heads of state and government officials of different countries around the world, in particular in the Middle East and in the US. So I think we can get started with our conversation. I have some questions that I prepared that I would like for us to go through, but as I said, I want you to have time to ask your questions yourselves, some questions yourself, so we will get there. So I wanted to start by asking you, what made you decide to become a broadcast journalist, and how perhaps did your childhood and years as a young adult informed your career decisions and, your professional life today?
Beatrice, thank you first off. It's really a huge pleasure for me to be with you and with everyone here at Grimshaw who's joining us for this discussion today. The question actually risks dating me a little bit. I risk dating myself. It was a long time ago that I decided to be a journalist. In fact, my childhood friends, remind me that I always knew what I wanted to be, and they say I wanted to be a journalist. Now, I do remember that I loved telling stories. as a student at school, and more so writing stories. So actually, in fact, I began my journalistic career as a print journalist before moving on to television news. I can definitely say, though, that during my university years in London at the School of Oriental and African Studies, not too far away from London School of Economics, I started taking a much bigger interest in what was going on around me and the world around me. As I sat down to write my dissertation, in those days I was doing international relations and later Middle Eastern studies, I was watching an interesting event unfold on my television screen. And that was the first Gulf War, which was, what, almost 30 years ago. I mean, I'm sure to a lot of you it will seem like last century, and indeed it was last century, but this was the first war that was unfolding in such a way in real time. I remember seeing these grainy night vision shots on the TV screen, guided missiles, cruise missiles, these satellite images that made it seem like it was a TV war drama unfolding before our very eyes. And I remember it was hard for me to focus, in fact, on my dissertation when I was just constantly just watching what was happening around me. And that made me really want to go more in depth into the region to discover the history of it, to look at the global context. But it also brought about sort of an interest in me to play a role at one point, potentially as a journalist, to tell the story from a different vantage point. Because what was happening at the time, all of the news that was coming out of that first Gulf War seemed to be news that was coming out of briefings with the US military to a large extent. And you remember the second Gulf War was one where we started living with the concept of embedded journalists. So really a very one-sided affair, it seemed to me. Of course, on the other side of the media landscape, you had the Middle Eastern Arab networks that were largely muzzled, that were, state-run, so with a lot of monitoring and supervision, so you couldn't trust those either. You had to take everything that was given to you with a pinch of salt. But my main problem was that the whole war was being made to look overly sanitized, that we weren't seeing the real impact beyond this glorification of that war. We weren't seeing the devastating impact it was having, that these missiles that we could see sort of in the distance were actually having on people, the devastation, the death toll. And so as I was finishing my post-grad degrees, in international relations and then Middle Eastern studies, I felt like I wanted to know more and I wanted to get involved much more. But fundamentally though, I think what has always attracted me, Beatrice, to journalism was this ideal of wanting to seek the truth, to uncover the truth, to hold those in power accountable. I know what has always motivated me as a journalist, although I have to say it is quite often easier said than done, especially in today's hugely polarized world where basic truths have become so subjective in many respects.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's very relatable for a lot of people who are here interested in journalism and reporting and writing. Very fascinating, thank you. Because we're all students here, I was wondering if you could also share with us maybe your first encounter with the professional work after university. So after, writing your dissertation and experiencing all of that, because we tend to focus always when we talk to accomplished professionals on what they're doing right now. But I wonder what you started off by doing when you left university.
Absolutely. But I do have to admit, though, that having a conversation with my 10-year-old cheeky daughter yesterday, I was telling her how excited I was to be speaking to a group of students today about my career, to which she quickly replied, "Why? Why would they have an interest in hearing that?" So that's my charming daughter for you. And there have been comments over the years about why couldn't you possibly find a more fun job to do? I mean, I think that the travel also got to her a little bit. I was leaving her a bit too often in her early years, but also the idea of a fun job. And so what is a fun job? So in her eyes, a fun job would have been being a baker, a painter, an astronaut, but I would disqualify definitely for some of those. I do not have the cooking skills to be a baker, and I don't think I would have fit the bill as an astronaut. So here I am 25 years after having chosen this profession, still happy to be a journalist. But going back to the early years, I remember when I was a graduate student in London, I actually I was wondering what to do. I had no idea. I'd finished my undergraduate studies, still looking for what really was my vocation. And so the idealist in me wanted to sort of do something that would help me change the world, you know, like so many of us like to sort of think, to have a purpose in life. And I thought, okay, fine, the obvious way might be to maybe join an international organization like the United Nations. It could help me do my bit, you know, focus on developmental issues, human rights issues. And I remember, in fact, there was a lecture at LSE that I attended on how to join the UN. And in those days, I think it's still is the case, but you had to be enrolled in a master's program. So I went along, and as a result of that lecture, I applied for an internship to the United Nations in New York. Little did I know at the time that it would take forever. It took about 6 months for the bureaucracy to work and for me to get back the acceptance. I eventually did do that internship, which was a wonderful, wonderful experience. But as I waited restlessly, having given in my dissertation without much to do, I was doing some voluntary work here and there, organizing conferences and lectures with a group of students at SOAS, and calling into newspapers and some, you know, media outfits, calling into journalists, inviting them to attend. And it's one thing that leads to the other. In fact, one of those phone calls was to a journalist at a Middle East publication who then was telling me they were looking for a researcher. I probably had a whole database of people I could maybe mention or suggest to him, to which the notion of even being a journalist, I think that sort of idea from my childhood, that dream of wanting to be a journalist, suddenly came back to me. And I said, can I come in actually and meet with you? So I was sort of in my early mid-20s at the time. And so I went in, fixed my CV overnight, and just went in and met him. And yeah, and I decided to join that that newspaper for a while as a researcher, then went off and did my internship and came back. And I think in life, you also, you know, take the opportunities that you offer to make the best out of them. I went to New York, did the internship. It was a wonderful 3-4 months there. But I realized suddenly that I personally couldn't, you know, build my entire career within the constraints, within the confines of a large international organization or a bureaucracy. And I would rather be looking at it from a critical perspective, looking at its work and its failings and its successes. And that's what I ended up doing. In fact, when I came back, I continued working with the newspaper for about 4 years, got myself, or got the bureau chief to agree to send me to the UN when I came back every year in September for the UN General Assembly, where you had the meeting of heads of states and government. And I, as a result, I ended up doing some fascinating interviews. It took a lot of work, a lot of long hours, you know, working on those, but it was absolutely worthwhile. And again, and some interesting places that you visit as well as a result, you know, places like Iran and Iraq, and being able to report from there and see firsthand what the situation is, being able to sort of mix both the news reports, the interviews, but also the human stories that you want to tell the world about. Those were really priceless, wonderful opportunity, I think. But you have to also seize the moment and just push for those opportunities and believe in yourself. At the time, I wasn't even a full-fledged journalist yet. And I looked around me, I wasn't even allowed into the daily editorial meetings at that time. But and then when I eventually was, I was the only woman there and the youngest too. So of course, that brings up a whole other set of issues as to how fast you need to prove yourself and be taken seriously.
Yeah, well, what a journey. But thank you for sharing that with us. I think it's important, especially because sometimes we overlook the opportunities that can come from like a small internship or, you know, work and from reaching out. So that makes a lot of sense. Now I wanted to talk a little bit more about your work today. So as I said before, Hida moderates conversations and she conducts interviews, you know, with some of the world's most powerful and influential people. So I was wondering, how do you prepare for those interviews? What's your thought process? What kinds of questions you try to ask, and what's on your mind, or what's your goal when you're thinking about, okay, how am I going to approach this person?
I mean, each interview brings about its own set of challenges. I think a lot of psychology needs to go into them, but of course it varies widely in terms of preparation. If it's a 3-5 minute interview, and if it is a 30-minute sit-down. I mean, over the years, I've done my fair share of both, but my goal is to always try to bring something new, something beneficial for the viewer. So it's not about going after the gotcha moments, but really trying to bring out something that viewers or readers didn't know about, something newsworthy. And there's always that balance between, you know, being aggressive with your line of questioning and just throwing softballs. So I think it's a delicate balance that you have to try to walk with each interview. But I know I've had a few moments where the interviews have not gone the way the interviewee might have expected, where they probably thought this was going to be nice and easy and quite gentle, and it didn't quite turn out this way, whether it was to do with my loaded questions or whether it was to do with just the follow-ups that they didn't expect. I've had on a couple of occasions, for example, people walk out after a couple of questions, or a 30-minute sit-down turning into just barely 10 minutes or less. I remember the president of the World Bank at one point. I mean, he was supposed to sit down with me for an extended period of time, but I think after two questions, he was done, he was gone. And I was once interviewing a former US ambassador at the UN, Richard Holbrooke. Again, the interview cut down drastically. So it's a bit like, I say, like a fishing expedition interviewing. You want to reel in the interviewee fast enough, but not too fast at the risk of losing them. So it's a very tricky balance, but one that I enjoy because of the challenge that it presents. But the key for me, though, in every interview is to be as well prepared as I can be. There have been occasions where interviews have been sprung up on me, where I haven't had the benefit of sitting down and really doing all the research I can. But I think it's crucial, maybe also as a woman more so, because of some of the sexist elements that you kind of sometimes are presented with. But I think in general, as an interviewer, you need to be taken seriously with the facts that you have at your fingertips. And again, for any interview not to degenerate into a sort of argument with the person you're interviewing, especially if you know it's going to be a contentious interview, you need to be able to back up your interviews with facts. I remember enjoying an interview that I did once at the Pentagon with the Secretary of Defense at the time, Donald Rumsfeld, in the lead up to the Iraq War. And in this case, actually, it was supposed to be 30 minutes, and he ended up wanting to do it for longer and asked me to keep going. And I said, but you're not answering my questions. So we did keep going for 45 minutes. It was interesting because to me, you know, I'm going to wait. I'm going to just listen to what the person is saying, give them a fair chance to give their perspective, but then really be sitting there taking notes and coming right back at them with some facts. And when you do that, it really puts them in a different place. They're on the defensive. They're taking this far more seriously and really sitting up and making sure they do their best to answer the question. So I do enjoy the more challenging, contentious interviews, I have to say. I tend to want to be strategic, like a chess player might be. And I say this without even knowing how to play chess. And my daughter has been trying to teach me, but I just don't get it. But as an interviewer, I definitely try to think hard about how I want to begin the interview and where it's going to take me. I don't want to corner myself unnecessarily. So it's about anticipating what the interviewee might say to you. And again, based on the research you do, because, you know, with Google these days, I mean, there's a lot you can dig about any single person you're interviewing. So what have they said in the past about this issue? What are the facts that you might want to use, given what you think they will say? And quite often, you know, they end up the interview saying, wow, you were tough, or wow, this was well researched. And to me, it's sort of basic. It's just the way the job needs to be done. I also learned through the years that you need to control the interview from the beginning. And it's a tricky balance again, because you don't want to cut someone off when they've barely had a minute to speak. But if you really give them the impression, or, you know, put them too much at ease that they can just go on uninterrupted, I don't think that does anyone any good. You need to show who's in control in that sense as a journalist, as the interviewer. And if you know that they're veering off topic, as they often do, because that's what politicians tend to do, you want to bring them right back and show them that you are serious about getting an answer to your question. So it's always been quite interesting, I have to say, to make sure that they don't divert and evade answering the questions. Yeah. So it's a tricky balance, but it's an interesting one.
Yeah, very interesting. My next question has much to do with that. It's about when you have to interview people with whose policies you don't agree. For example, leaders who, you know, abuse human rights in their own countries, or who are doing something completely despicable. How do you make sure that you remain professional at all times, so that you ensure that no one can accuse you of attacking the person, but rather, you know, you're doing your job as a journalist?
You know, it's difficult at times because the point is not to personalize it too much, to be as factual as you can be, to remain respectful as well, even when you're facing someone with sort of the proverbial blood on their hands. You want to be almost like a judge, allow them to answer the questions without sort of looking overly prosecutorial, but still pinning them down and not letting them get away with too many sort of falsehoods or half-truths, because I think that's our job, to be able to challenge the person to the extent possible so that we're able to give the viewer or the reader the information they need. Of course, we can never know it all, but I mean, to the extent possible, we need to be absolutely well-researched and ready for the interview. I think it's, you know, you get accused of being biased, of course, especially in today's polarized world. And of course, working as I do here in the United States in Washington, it's difficult to be even-handed all the time or completely balanced when you're interviewing members of this party or that. So you get accused of being biased. And, you know, I have to say, yes, of course I'm biased, but I am biased towards the truth. I certainly won't be biased towards this party or the other, even though you have to hold them to different standards, because the party that is in power has to be held to, I think, a different standard to the one that isn't, because it's not just about what they say, it's about what they're actually doing. And I think there's that myth surrounding journalism in general, that journalism is neutral, that it is supposed to be, and that it is. But I think by the choice of the topics that we cover, the guest who we invite on, the people we interview, there's already that kind of value judgment that we make. There's a political angle that we know we're going to pursue. So I think the issue is to be fair more than it is to be neutral.
That's interesting.
And I think I can give you a bit, Liz, if you want, a couple of examples of people I've interviewed, in fact, when I was reporting from the United Nations a few years ago. I mean, one that comes to mind was the late Shimon Peres, the former president of Israel. This was on the margins of the UN General Assembly. And I remember at the time, on the day, I had just come out of another half-hour sit-down interview with the Bolivian president, Evo Morales. My editors, I was with Al Jazeera English at the time, my editors called me up and say, well, you've got an hour and we need you actually across town, across Manhattan, forget all the security measures that were in place at the time and all the traffic. So we need you out there in an hour to interview Shimon Peres. And I was just telling you, it goes against my principles to sit down with someone without having done the adequate research, let alone if it's a head of state. That's the last thing you want to do. So I tried to wiggle my way out of it, not because I didn't relish the opportunity, but because there was not enough time. I couldn't. They said, absolutely not. We need you to do it. We've invested so much in you. You've got to go out and do it. All right. So off I went, thinking I would just literally keep it to two questions. At the time, the big issue of the day was the Iran nuclear program. So I thought, okay, a couple of questions and I'm done. I barely had time to print out a couple of wire stories and off I went. So literally reading them in the taxi ride over to the other side of Manhattan is all I had in terms of time to prepare. And to his surprise, I mean, and to the constant huffing of his aides standing behind me, we went for a full 30 minutes. And I think he was expecting a far less challenging interview and presumably a certain standard of questioning on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and maybe a couple of questions about Iran and nothing much more. And so I think I took him off guard here by going to a place where not many journalists had been with Israeli officials, by turning the tables in a sense and asking him about his country's own nuclear weapons program. So it was an interesting sit down, at the end of which he shook my hand and said, oh, you were tough. But his aides were certainly trying to put me off. And I tried to sort of ignore the huffing that I was hearing behind me. Another example on the margins again of the General Assembly of the UN was Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan leader. He was at the UN that year. He had given a hugely lengthy speech, I think that went on for like 90 minutes. The interpreter, I think, collapsed in the booth because of the pressure of having to go on for that amount of time. It's really pressure filled. So I remember he granted me the interview and it was really late one evening at the Libyan mission. It was just one of two interviews that he was giving on that trip. One was to Larry King, CNN, and the other one was to me, but he was coming to the UN as chairman of the African Union. So here again is a situation where, yes, I could have asked him far more about human rights issues in his own country. And I remember a friend of mine, a fellow journalist, a Libyan, was quite upset with me for not having pushed him far more on this. And I did not go down that route deliberately because there was other issues that I want to bring up within a more global context. There was the Lockerbie issue as well. And I didn't want to relitigate things that he might have said in the past with a local journalist. I wanted to really try to bring something new to the table. And I think otherwise it's not all that productive. And of course, you can never cover everything, even if you've got a half hour, and keep everyone very happy in the process. But I think as long as you do enough justice to yourself and what you're trying to achieve in terms of trying to bring out a couple of truths from those leaders, I think then you might have done a decent enough job. But am I always fully satisfied? No, I tend to be very critical and it's never easy within the time frame that you're given.
Yes, I understand. Yeah. It's a challenge though when you're interviewing, like, what should I ask? What exception should I push? What am I going to gain? Am I not gain anything if I choose this question? So we need to find other paths. That's very, very interesting. Share with us like a specific event in your career that kind of shaped how you think about your job, an opportunity or an interview or a project that marked you specifically and that you like think about from time to time.
I think more than a project, I think maybe a series of projects, actually a series of reports, but more like an event. An event, I think, that impacted a lot of people, certainly every journalist who covered it, was the events leading up to 9/11. Mm-hmm. So the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And I was in New York on that day. So like everyone else, I was completely shaken up by the events, waking up to discover what had happened, immediately being thrown on air, having just literally opened my eyes. I remember I believe it was a Tuesday, and my beat was the United Nations. So I thought it was safe enough to maybe sleep a little later than usual that day because there wasn't much going on. I looked at the agenda, there wasn't much, except that this thing happened. And I remember when I woke up the next morning, I had so many messages from headquarters, which was in Doha for Al Jazeera. And before I knew it, they're like, all right, we need you on air right now. So I literally switched on the TV. And before I knew it, I had to make sense of what was going on when no one really could. The first plane had hit, but not the second. But so yeah, I was stuck on air for a good 45 minutes, which seemed like forever, and then talked to the editors to let me off the hook so that I could actually go downtown and see what was happening for myself instead of just sort of zapping between the different channels and trying to understand what was exactly happening around us. But, you know, the fact that I was reporting for Al Jazeera in those days, and this was a network that wasn't yet globally known, but soon would become. The events took place in September. Obviously, in October, this is when the first Bin Laden tapes started sort of appearing and surfacing, and for the most part, being shown to the rest of the world through Al Jazeera, because it was the one sort of independent, well-established network. And so it was an obvious choice, I suppose, for Al-Qaeda in those days. But I found myself suddenly in the middle of this media frenzy, this spotlight in the United States, having to defend a certain narrative, having to answer the question, why do they hate us? And I was sort of almost harassed by some of the American networks, Fox and the others, to just appear, because suddenly there was a woman they could associate with this network, and let's bring her on and ask her those questions, to which I really honestly didn't have an answer. And neither did I want to appear like I was anyone's spokesperson, or that I was even trying to explain what these people were after, what kind of thinking they had. So you try to explain it's the policy that they find that they look at critically, but for the most part I tried to dodge some of these appearances, to be honest, and just focused on my work. But I think what happened in the days after 9/11 and the way the media in the United States started to look at things and at statements coming out of the White House, it almost felt like they were relinquishing an important part of what journalism should be all about, which is to be critical, to not just take whatever statements we get from the White House or any other official office, just like that, and repeating it without really questioning it too much. I mean, I know in the UK, obviously, and in Europe, having lived there for many years, it's quite different. But in the US, suddenly there was a sense of patriotism, which trumped anything else. You know, so in the name of patriotism, you didn't want to question too much. So I was just watching this and it was hard for me to sort of process, but I could understand why, but I didn't quite accept it as a journalist. And I think that led us onto this slippery slope of what then happened a few years later, leading us into the war in Iraq with Saddam Hussein's presumed weapons of mass destruction. The fact that the media in the US especially refused to really take on some of these assertions that were being made, refused to really go to the bottom of these claims without questioning enough. And I remember at one point I traveled to Baghdad and thought there was an interesting trip that I did with Kofi Annan when he was Secretary General of the UN and a bunch of other journalists. And it was interesting to see, the situation there, but this was before the invasion. But I say it was an eye opener for me as well as a journalist coming from a certain part of the world, reporting from the streets of New York. I mean, never would anyone ask me, where are you from? Where are you from? In such a threatening way. But there I was, you know, with a logo, with a speaking a language that they would associate with the perpetrators of the events of 9/11. And there was that sort of hostility almost. But so it was an eye opener. It was interesting on a personal level to be reporting on those events. And a few years later to, again, go to Baghdad after the invasion happened in 2003, 2004, and to be on a trip with the US Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and in many ways, quite a surreal experience as journalist to actually spend 3-4 nights in one of Saddam Hussein's former palaces. I was the only foreign journalist they took on that trip. Mm-hmm. They must have liked me enough after that interview I did with Rumsfeld, but so off I went. Interesting, but we were also given a steady diet of, I want to say, quote unquote, propaganda from the US side. In fact, I remember Rumsfeld admonishing us and all these American journalists who were with him for not covering the positive sides of the story, to which we said, what positive sides? You still have, you know, bombs going off every day in marketplaces, at schools. What exactly would you like us to cover? And so that's interesting, but that's the situation you find yourself as a journalist if you're doing your work. You get told off by officials quite often for not being positive enough. And yeah. Then I think you know that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I understand. Well, those seem like very remarkable events. I think we all kind of remember studying this in class and talking about this, but really talking to someone who was there reporting is extraordinary. So I wanted to change. You've talked a little bit about your experience as a woman, but so when I saw Hida for the first time, it was an event in Lisbon, and she was moderating a conversation between Samantha Power and this actress. And the whole conversation was about women and women in the world. And both of the speakers talked about their experiences in their respective fields. But at the time, I really felt like we should have heard from you and from your own experience, especially because you know interview with these powerful heads of state, mostly men in prominent positions. So how are your experience shaped by the fact that you are a woman? And did you struggle in the beginning, especially with like being taken seriously?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question because at some level, yes, I definitely was conscious early on about wanting to be taken seriously. Again, working for a Middle East publication, you can imagine men mostly around me, the women, if any, were sort of doing entertainment or other. And I was offered a job within the entertainment section of the newspaper, to which I immediately said no. And then, do you want to do something on the last page or the finance page? Not that, you know, not that there are more women doing finance than men, but at the time that was the availability. And again, I refused. I said, no, I want to just wait and be offered, and take whatever job I can get within the opening that I wanted, which was political affairs, which I eventually got. But of course you want it to be taken seriously. There's the age factor as well. If you're starting off young, and this was me 25 years ago, and I remember it even affected the way I dressed. I remember my colleague sitting next to me would always say, why are you always in pantsuits? You know, it ages you. And it's sort of, but that was me sort of trying to be taken seriously on the substance of what I had to offer. And I think it paid off over the years, where I remember on one or two occasions, I was actually asked to do an interview with these officials who felt that they were reading my bylines and the articles were so well-researched and so factual. So that was great for me. It was about the substance, you know, not so much you as a woman or not. But I think being a woman, has some advantages when you interview powerful men. because whether we like it or not, it sometimes gives them a false sense of ease. Certainly a sense of ease, but then they quickly discover that it may be a false sense of ease. When they sit down with a woman, we tend to be soft-spoken, gentle-looking. So they think quite often that they're in for an easy ride. So I think we're able to then do our job in a way that sort of surprises them, takes them back and takes them by surprise, which is also interesting. And I can share with you an instance, for example, when I remember, again, one of my many years covering the UN General Assembly, walking around the corridors. I remember waiting for an elevator, and so was the French foreign minister at the time, Bernard Kouchner. And I just bumped into him, didn't know him, but he seemed to be eager to sit down with me for an interview. Why not, he thought. And I said, sure. So I just walked him right into the room where I already had my two camera set up, ready to go. And obviously, he didn't expect the interview. It ended up being a half-hour interview to go the way he expected. I also used some of the knowledge, or at least the sources that I had, who'd given me some information about the meeting he just came out of. You know, the permanent five members of the UN Security Council back in those days, again, were focused on Iran. And I heard that it was a very contentious meeting, and I was given one or two interesting bits that I obviously, as it turned out, was able to use with him. And so that, you know, surprised him, I think. At one point, he even asked me why I kept picking on France. And I said, well, because I'm sitting with the French foreign minister, to which he chuckled and sort of pivoted to something else. So yeah, it's interesting, but I think you learn to look at it from an advantageous point of view. And I think it also has its advantages being a woman in this position.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that, like, things really are changing. And I mean, it's always a tricky question, and also very hard to answer, because there's undeniable like disadvantages, but that's very interesting. And I do think that women are taken seriously a lot more today than men.
And today there are far more women in this position, you know, as political journalists, than there were. I mean, I'm talking to you about a landscape that has changed so dramatically, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there may not have been as many, but now, yes, of course, it's a different situation altogether. Yeah,
definitely. Well, I have some other questions, but I'm sure that they will either come up through other people's questions, or I can bring them back. I can come back to them. So I was wondering if anyone has questions. I see that Marianne has a question, and it seems very good. So if you want to step up and ask your question, that would be fantastic. Marianne.
Hi, thank you for being with us. I just wanted to know if you would have any, like, do you have any advice for students or graduates who are interested in starting a career in journalism? Like, where should we, you know, where should we start applying to? Where should we look for job opportunities? Should we start by doing an internship?
Yeah, no, thanks, Marianne, for the question. It's interesting. I say sometimes, you know, things happen sort of in unexpected ways. So I, for example, didn't study journalism. But I think if you've got an enough of an interest in what's going on around you, which you obviously do in international relations, I think that's a very good background to have, to then use it to the best effect within a journalistic context. But I'd say a couple of things on what sort of advice I might give. I'd say a couple of things. I'd say definitely go with your heart. You persevere. Don't give up if this is the sort of thing you feel you're attracted to, and know that it's not easy, that it's got its challenges, it's a cutthroat business, but that it is also rewarding. It's exciting, and it gives you a sense of purpose, unless some would argue you're working for sort of networks like, well, I shouldn't say Fox News or working for Murdoch, but no, on a serious note, I think it gives you a sense of purpose to be in the thick of things and to be able to report and shed light on the issues that matter. So for me, it's a hugely rewarding profession, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else. But how do you get into it? You know, internships are a good idea. I think they're a very good foot into this world if you can find opportunities within media networks. I mean, in the UK, you've got so many channels and newspapers that I'm sure would offer this, especially to LSE graduates. So I would definitely encourage you know, seeing and being proactive, by the way, just sort of sending an email or a message to anyone within a network that you identify that you might like enough, and just doing it and being pushy that way. In fact, I'll tell you, when I first started off and I went sort of randomly to that interview that was, you know, for the researcher job at the newspaper in London, I remember going in there and just wanting to see, almost wanting to smell what a sort of printing house looked like. Again, just wanting to see. So you just go and learn, and every meeting sort of, you know, leads to someplace else that you might not have expected. So I went in not really thinking I was going to work, especially not in a challenging language as well for me, which was Arabic at the time, for that newspaper. I didn't think I would do it, but I thought it's worth just going and seeing what this place looks like. And then again, one thing leads to the other. But when I did get that offer to join the newspaper sort of without expecting it, I then quickly picked up the phone and just decided to call an executive at one of the media outlets that were there. At the time, it was called the Middle East Broadcasting Corporation. It was the only one of its kind. It was quite a pioneering, you know, media outlet. So I just called up someone who could make a quick decision and tell me whether I could come in and meet with him. So I think you want to be pushy, you want to be proactive, especially if you feel you've got something to offer. So I picked up the phone, called this guy who was in a position to tell me, yes, we have an opening or we don't. Because of course you can go through the route of doing it through HR. But I think if you can identify someone, and these days we've got social media, so you can easily, whether it's on LinkedIn or any other platform, try to see who you might be able to get in touch with and ask for a meeting. And that's what I did in quite a pushy way. This person told me, you know, well, I'm traveling maybe next week or the following week. I said, no, it's got to be this week. I've got to come and see you. And I'm this graduate from SOAS. I love journalism. I mean, I put in, you know, the pitch of my life, but it was really from the heart. So I said, I must absolutely come and see you this way. So you want to do it, especially if there's nothing to lose. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? That's always been my attitude, is you just get a no. And I think we can all live with that. But imagine the flip side. I did get a meeting with this person. I walked in, but what he had to offer was really not what I wanted. So suddenly, again, the sexist sort of woman factor that sometimes kicks in. Before even looking at my CV and studying it, he wondered if I wanted a quick to be, you know, he called makeup and sound to see whether they might just make me fit within their entertainment schedule. And I sort of quickly backed out and said, that's really not what I was interested in. So know what you want, push for it, but also be flexible enough, I think, to take the smaller opportunities that come up. So I remember walking out of my flat in London, going to that first interview, which was for a researcher job. In fact, it was secretarial / researcher, so it wasn't even... And so, and having just sort of done 2 master's degrees, I remember my mom asking me, where are you going? And I told her, oh, it's this job, you know, secretary. I said, are you crazy? I mean, you've just studied this hard. You've just come out with these 2 degrees and surely you're going to aim a bit higher than this. I said, Mom, you have to have an open mind. And I still went. And very quickly, you then, you know, make something out of nothing and prove yourself. And I have no regrets. I'm glad in a way that I took that longer route. And that I'd started as well as a woman in print journalism to establish myself, to learn the foundations. I'm not saying that's how it needs to be today. No, you can go straight into television if that's what you want. But for me, I enjoyed doing it this way. It gave me more confidence, building my way through easily. So I would say, yes, internships are great. But as a friend, an American friend from NBC told me many, many, many years ago, he said, you know, these jobs are so hard to come by that you take any job you get offered. If you want to be a TV journalist, any job you get offered. So again, secretarial or not, but it's up to you to decide. You take it as a foot in and you work your way up. And that's what some of the biggest names in journalism have done, whether it's Christiane Amanpour or all of the others. These are inspiring stories to show you that, yeah, there's nothing that's too small. You just go in there and then work your way up. And I always tend to think in 6-month frameworks, at least that's worked for me. I say we've nothing to lose to try something out. And if within those 6 months, for you, it might be 3 or 4, but for me, 6 months was good. You'd find out whether this was even something for you, if you enjoyed it, if you were any good at it, and someone I always felt would pay attention to you. And I remember when I first started and did the pivot to TV journalism. I then from London went to New York and started reporting for a Middle East broadcasting channel. Within 4 months, I had a top executive at CNN call me up and ask whether she could meet with me and how long I'd been doing this. So I said, almost 6 months, when it had barely been 3 or 4, but I needed to give her a sense of, and she laughed and she thought, you know, and before I knew it, yes, I was meeting with her and being offered a job and the rest of it. So yeah, I mean, just go with your heart is essentially, and follow your instinct. I mean, that's the one thing that I say, you don't have to, it doesn't have to make too much sense. You don't have to rationalize it or explain it to anyone but yourself, but just follow your instinct. And persevere if it's something that you enjoy doing. And the proof is, here I am. I took a hiatus of a couple of years, actually, a few years ago after I left Al Jazeera English, was focusing on moderating. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time to do something entirely different. And the truth is, I couldn't think of anything different that excited me enough. So I think by doing something and not doing it and then taking a step back, you will know what it is that you want to do. And I honestly don't know if I answered your question, but I would say go for it, be proactive, believe in yourself, and just go for it. If you feel like you want to put the work and everything you have in it, then you will be able to do it without a problem. You just have to sort of push that door open and seize the opportunities that present themselves, however small they might seem at the time.
Beatrice. Yeah, thank you for your question, Marianne.
Marianne, sorry, I don't know if I answered your question appropriately, but that's what I would say.
I think so. Oh, thank you, Marianne, for your question. So Halek, she has a question about your time in Afghanistan, and you know, Halek, do you want to step up and ask your question?
Thank you, Beatrice. I'm very sorry I can't have my video on. I'm crossing the Waterloo Bridge at the moment. But thank you so much, Hida, for the last 40 minutes. I'm absolutely enamored by the work you've done. I have actually two quick questions, if you have the time to answer them. First of all, I mean, I've myself considered journalism through international relations, but there's sort of a moral dilemma here. I mean, being there, you worked in Iraq and Afghanistan, you've been on site, being there but reporting about it but not being able to do anything about it physically while you're there. I mean, what about that moral dilemma? How do you get out of it? How do you get out of that frame of mind? And my second question to you is about Afghanistan specifically, because that's a region I'm very interested in, and what your time was like over there, and considering it's a forgotten war now, mostly. So what do you think of when you think back on those times when you were there yourself? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, look, I have to say, I didn't spend enough time in Afghanistan. I did make the one trip to Afghanistan, and this was back in 2003, 2004. And it was a very quick trip. In fact, it was sort of surreal. And it was just, you know, with the Defense Secretary of the United States. So it was literally in and out. It was, as we spent 3 days in Iraq, we then spent less than 24 hours in Afghanistan, enough time to go to Kabul, to the presidential palace. He had a meeting with Hamid Karzai, who I've interviewed a couple of times over the years, but not enough time to really gauge exactly what was going on, but enough time to see that the country was, you know, in such a situation that you wanted, yeah, you felt helpless. You wanted to sort of tell the story of the people there, the women, the men who you came across, but ever so fleetingly, and you weren't able to do full justice to it just in a quick sort of trip where you get parachuted in, as it were. But over the years, just looking back and reading about Afghanistan, interviewing people, Afghans, it's one of those heartbreaking situations where, in some respects, you know, there's been progress. People will tell you, well, look, now girls get to go to school and so on. Now there's the question of what happens if the Taliban come back to power in any kind of power sharing agreement with the government. But it's one of those, yeah, heart-wrenching situations where, you know, I go back and say, you know, you can never attain, you know, the ideal of a democracy when it comes off the barrel of a gun or after an invasion. And, you know, I don't know how you would feel about this, but my sense is, with respect to Iraq or Afghanistan, I've always been skeptical about what a war could achieve long-term. And I think you look at the situation in Iraq as well, which is completely off the radar, it seems now. We've forgotten about it. There's so much else, so much chaos around the world that we forget. And I wonder how many people continue to die on a daily basis. As you say, forgotten wars, but by no means settled situations. And your heart, of course, breaks, and there's so much you can do. And with this crazy quick pace of the 24/7 news cycle, and you add to it the franticness of the Twitter world, you don't know where to look anymore. And I think for those of us who cover the United States, there's so much going on here, as it were, the whole dangers that are being posed currently to U.S. democracy and the Constitution, that it's hard to be on top of everything. It's a tough one, but I wish I was able to spend more time in places like Iraq and report from there. And it's not always a given. You speak to politicians, and of course, they'll always put their spin on the situation. So you don't never get a real sense of what people are going through. I did meet a group of young women working in the IT sector, in fact, and coding and all that in Doha last year when I was doing one of those Doha debates. So young women from Afghanistan, and they seemed to be excited about the future. They didn't seem to be too scared about the prospects of what if we go backwards, if the Taliban come back in any way into the government. So there's a sense that they have achieved quite a bit over the last few years. And I think they want to look at things positively and feel that they can make a difference. And I think women will be at the center of a lot of what's going on, even though in those negotiations that happened a couple of years ago, they were completely sidelined. But I think since then, it's clear that women will be playing an important role. And I think that's the way it should be, especially in these societies where we don't associate women with, you know, being, you know, in the front line, but they often are. When I reported from Iran once, I was surprised to see, you know, people in the West tend to think, oh, these women, you know, they're submissive, they're in the background, they're wearing their chadors and so on, but it's really not the case. In fact, they are pushing and shoving and making sure that they are in every single profession, whether it's in the legal profession, whether they're, you know, journalists or, you know, I met so many professional women, but that was a long time ago. And I remember how inspired I was and how different it is from the stereotyping that often happens in the West, where you think, oh, these poor women are sort of living in the Stone Age, but they're not. And they're making their voices heard in more ways than people sort of tend to give them credit for. Yeah.
Well,
but the moral dilemma, I don't think I answered that. The moral dilemma is, yeah, as I said, it's hard. It's hard to see and not to be able to do very much about it. But as a journalist, at least, even if it makes not much of a significant difference, if you're able to shed light on a situation, I think for me, that's important enough, and change one or two minds just by virtue of showing the reality from a different vantage point, I think then it's mission accomplished in many respects.
Well, thank you very much for your answers. Thank you for your two questions, Alex. We have another question by Chizaki. I hope I'm saying your name right. Would you like to ask your question?
Oh, hi, Chizaki. Good to see you in the flesh. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your talk. And I'm an international relations student, and I'm quite interested in becoming a journalist after I graduate. And I would like to know more about how the academic subject of international relations can be applied to the field of journalism and how you found it's related, how you found it can be applied.
You know, it's just like, I think it's the key actually field that can be applied in such a natural way and in such an important way to journalism. I often would be asked, you know, did you go to journalism school? Do you have to study journalism to be a journalist? I mean, and the short answer, not just for me, but just looking at the way people around me have done it, it's no. You just have to have enough interest in what's going on around you in global affairs and the way that the world works, the different institutions, governments, civil society, all of that stuff, I think. I mean, you couldn't do better than being a student of international relations. So I think it's the absolutely right place to be if you wanted to then take it to that different direction and sort of, look at the world from a critical perspective, be a journalist, whether it's in print or in TV, having that foundation, knowing and caring and being interested in the way the world works and the relations between governments and countries, I think is the best foundation you can have. I think it's the best springboard. It's definitely the one I used to get into this this business. Yeah, so I never went down sort of the more traditional route. And I don't think many people have. I think back to my peers in this industry, I don't think for the majority that they went to journalism school. In fact, they did something like international relations and then used it to their advantage to have that sort of global outlook and to be able to put things within that global context, things that you sort of only learn if you're a student of international relations, in addition to being genuinely interested. And I think these days we all are, and we can't escape what's going on in the world around us, even when we need to. And I think that's the challenge these days of being a journalist, is just the quickness of everything, not just the 24/7 news cycle, but you know, Twitter and Google, and it's information coming at you constantly. And for us, it's a challenge as a journalist these days. I mean, I do I have a weekly program these days on TRT World that's focused on US politics. And I have another monthly show that's more global affairs issues and issues of global injustice and the United Nations system. And I have to say that is so easy to do compared to the program on US politics, because there's such a quickness to what's going on. There are constant tweets, it's a constant barrage that if I don't have my head focused on it completely, I know that I'm missing out on something. So I'm never able to switch this little thing off, like many of you, I'm sure, aren't. But us being journalists, it means that we're also driven by what's going on in the news and wanting to also make news. It's just a constant race. So that's the challenge, but I think the rewards obviously far outweigh these challenging bits of being able to switch off your phone. Yeah, but I don't think these days any of us can anymore. So that's the world we live in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your question, Chisaki. If anyone else has questions, I think we still got 10, 15 minutes. So write a little bit, write them down. I have two to finish off. So I wanted to ask, for those of you who don't know, so Hida has this program called Inside America. And 2 days ago, she covered the for TRT World, the VP debate, the vice president debate. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your perspective in relation to what's going on in the US right now, but also the perspective, a wider perspective from a journalist, and what the role of journalists should be at a time in which, you know, as you said, the US democracy is in peril. And what's the role of journalists under those circumstances?
I think it's a critical role that journalists play, and even more so today, Beatrice, than in previous years and previous election cycles. And I'm speaking from a US perspective, but I think it applies to so many other parts of the world. Because, as you say, democracy, US democracy seems to be in true peril. The way this administration has addressed so many of the challenges, the doubts it has sowed in the integrity of the elections, the justice system, the courts, the media, and we're supposed to be the fourth estate, right? We're supposed to be sort of that fourth branch of government that holds politicians to account. So to hear the president here in the US call the media constantly the enemy of the people, I mean, that's quite serious, and you've got to keep going and do your job. But it's such a polarized environment these days. And it has been for a few years, but now much more than before. I mean, every newspaper has its partisan leaning. Every TV channel that you switch to no longer has a hidden or toned down tone to it. To the contrary, it's projected in very, very vivid ways. And with the ongoing debates that we've seen, obviously the first presidential debate, when was it, last week, which I won't even comment on, which could be the first and the last of this election cycle, because right now the commission, as I'm sure you follow, it says it wants to do a virtual debate next because of the president's COVID-19 positive diagnosis. He says he's not willing to do it, but we'll see what happens between now and then. The second debate, which was, as you say, Beatrice, the vice presidential debate that I did cover in my pre and post sort of analysis, was a much more civilized affair between Pence and Harris, and we expected it to be, I mean, given both their personalities. But I have to say, I was a little bit disappointed as a moderator, let's say. I mean, yes, I have moderated never a presidential debate, that's for sure. My husband would love me to do one of those, but, you know, but I've done lots of high-level panel discussions, and of course the stakes are always going to be high. Nothing compared to a presidential debate, that's for sure. But I think the job of the moderator is really to make sure that the questions he or she asks are in fact answered. You know, politicians are always going to pivot to what they want to talk about, that's for sure. But you can't allow them to simply disregard some of your key questions, you know, in the allotted time. And that in my books, for me, as a journalist, as an interviewer, as a moderator, I feel is a complete no-no. I mean, you want to be fair, but you definitely want to be firm. And so there's a lot at stake. And I think there's a lot of scrutiny on the moderators. But here in the US, it seems to be done in a different way than it is in the UK, where moderators, especially in those debates, tend to be very scripted. So they tend to follow a script, which is fine. You know, I do interviews where, of course, I go in with a few scripted questions. Absolutely. But you want to be able to just disregard those and follow up on some of these answers or non-answers, especially when it's such crucial information at a time like this, where you still have people who are undecided here in the US. I believe I heard something to the tune of now it's just about 5% of the voting public here in the US that's undecided, and it's what, 3+ weeks to go. So not a lot of time to go. So you think by now people have made up their mind whether they're voting for Biden or for Trump. But at this same point, 4 years ago, it was about 50% who were undecided. So I think by now, I mean, it's the candidates are so diametrically opposed, and we've had 4 years of Trump, so people know whether they want to vote for him or not. But still, I mean, you didn't ask me this, but just my sense of living here, I don't know to what extent all of you in the UK sense this, the country is hugely divided, huge polarization. You've got a firm 40% in Trump's camp, no doubt, 40% on the other side, and these 5 to 10% in between. It's all going to boil down to how many people actually end up going out and voting. You know, this whole issue of voter participation. And even though we're going through this pandemic and there's a lot of mail-in voting that's going on, there's also more than 4 million people who've already voted in early voting. So I think the key will be to see how each side turns out the vote or suppresses the vote, depending on, you know, which side is sort of, yeah, talking about it.
We're less than a month from finding out. So let's see.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. So I want to wrap up with a question about what's the most frustrating and the most rewarding thing about your job.
The most frustrating and the most rewarding. I think one of the most frustrating is to be able to operate these days within this quick Twitter sphere, to be on top of things when there is just so much going on. I think that's difficult. You know, not being able to switch off, knowing where to go for the news, taking certain social media outlets and the information that is on them with a healthy pinch of salt, knowing what's fact versus what's not. And so there's a lot thrown out at you, and just sifting through all of this and knowing how much credibility to give to all of this is difficult. And I knew, and I've always been, maybe this is me again showing my age, but I've always been sort of a skeptic when it comes to social media. Sort of I'm a reluctant tweeter. I sort of do it because I have to, because as a journalist, I feel like I need to. But it's not something that I embrace wholeheartedly. And I think a few years ago, you know, with the so-called Arab Spring, we saw that it could be a double-edged sword in the sense that social media can be used, yes, to great effect by activists who want to spread the word and organize themselves. But I knew even from back then, a few years ago, that it would actually also be used one day quite effectively by governments and intelligence services who also want to sort of mislead us about what's going on. And there's a lot of it obviously going on right here within the context of the US elections. And in fact, it's one of the topics I'll be doing 2 weeks from now on my show, this whole Facebook, Twitter phenomenon, and how these corporations have become larger than life, and that they have an unchecked amount of power, and they can influence elections in a huge way. Again, to subvert, many people would argue, democracy. So it'd be interesting to see what people say on this. But I think in terms of the more rewarding aspects is this fact that you are able to be a part of history making in a way that you're able to shed light on the important issues of the day, that hopefully you're able to bring forward new perspectives And it's something that I know I enjoy doing. You know, on any given show, you want to make sure that you've got either side of the spectrum represented. Even if you know that instinctively you're going to give one side a harder time than the other, you try not to. You try not to as much, but you want to make sure that they both have an opportunity to put forward their perspectives, that you are able to hold them to account to the extent possible. And when you look at the landscape in countries where the media doesn't have this sort of freedom, I think you then immediately can tell that the rewards are so huge and that it's such an important part to play for us as journalists. I still have to convince my daughter, who's, as I say, is a skeptic of everything I do. She still doesn't get the extent of the importance of being a journalist. I keep, you know, saying to her, well, look, see, this is what happens when a journalist holds someone to account. If I see a good interview being done, and all right, she still doesn't buy it completely, but I'm sure she will one day. She's still young, but I think it's you know, it's a profession that I think is a fantastic profession. It's a noble profession. The waters these days tend to be a little murky now with this whole citizen journalism going on as well. But I think if you go back to the basics and approach it the way it needs to be approached, which is bringing forward the facts and just helping people sort of have a better understanding of what's going on, I think that's the essence of what it is. And that's, for me, why I'm in this industry and why I would encourage everyone who has enough of an appetite for it to pursue it. I think it's really hugely, hugely rewarding, even if it makes a little bit of difference in people's minds. It's important enough. And it's every mind that you change through the facts that you present that to me are important enough. And just presenting a different perspective, looking at things from a different vantage point is something that I enjoy. And I hope that I do on occasion.
Yeah, well, brilliant. Thank you so much for that positive kind of end. This was really, really nice. Thank you everyone who joined us today. And also, I think we can all give a big, big thank you to Rida for joining us and for taking the time for this.
Beatrice, thank you so much. I really want to thank you as well and everyone who joined us. I didn't get to see everyone's faces, but I hope you're all still there and found something interesting to take away from this discussion. But I wanted to say, good luck with everything you do and with everything you pursue. And if you did pursue this path, I think it'd be one that you don't regret. And of course, do reach out to me if there's anything sort of I can do in sort of shedding light on what it is like being a journalist. I would love to be in touch, Beatrice. So please do feel free. I mean, you know my contacts, and I'd be more than happy to engage in a one-on-one discussion or by email with any of you.
Thank you very much. It has really been an invaluable conversation. I would highly recommend you all to check Rida's website and to follow closely her programs. As she said, she has the International Affairs one and then the most recent one, which is Inside America. They provide really interesting insights with like great guests, and Rida always asking the questions and raising the debates we need answers to. So thank you all once again. I have nothing to add. This was brilliant. So I'll see you soon in another Grimshaw event. Thank you, Rida, so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I will end.
Thank you so much for the invite. Truly appreciate having been with you. Thank you so much. Take care and all the best to all of you, Beatrice. And I hope you stay in touch as well.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Many thanks to our speaker, Rida Fakhri. The music for this podcast was produced by Ash Layo Masing. We hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information on the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound, check out our social media and websites.